Test. Turn it on. You getting a reading there? Okay, good. Okay, take your Bibles and turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 9. 1 Chronicles chapter 9. Pick it up there. Last week we finished up chapter 8. We're running through these first 9 chapters rather quickly and just kind of pulling out the highlights of each chapter. We'll pull out a few things of chapter 9. Then when we get into chapter 10, we'll slow down, take a little better look at the things when we get into the events of 1 Chronicles. And I'm still going to have to move kind of quickly. I want to try and finish 1 Chronicles in one semester. And so that means we're going to have to do about 2 chapters a night, at least 2.5 chapters a night. And we're right on schedule right so far. Okay, 1 Chronicles chapter 9. Now, before I start this, I do want to make a correction from last week, something I gave you a reference. I gave you those 7 names of Joshua last week, and the one reference in Nehemiah, I told you it was Nehemiah 13:16. That's incorrect, okay? It's Nehemiah 12:1. Nehemiah 12:1. So if you want to look back in your notes real quick there and change that, on that reference on Joshua, should have been Nehemiah 12:1 instead of Nehemiah 13:16. I don't know how I got that mixed up. You know, usually doesn't happen, but I don't make that many mistakes, you know. That's probably about the first one this year, I guess. So, y'all can laugh. That's a joke. Well, you need to loosen up a little bit. Okay. So, I want you to have that. So, one of my students pointed that out to me. I won't tell you who it was. Okay. Chapter 9 now. 1 Chronicles chapter 9. And let me give you an outline for the chapter. There's two points, two Roman numerals. Roman numeral number 1 is the Jews who return from Babylon. What it's going to do, it's going to jump ahead and kind of give you some of the Jews that came back under Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah. And that's verses 1 to 34. That's Jews who return from Babylon. Roman numeral number 1. That's verses 1 to 34. Thank you. Okay, Roman numeral number 2 are the genealogies of Saul. The genealogy of Saul. The genealogy of Saul, and that's verses 35 to 44. 35 to 44. Okay, First Chronicles 9:1. So all Israel was reckoned by genealogies, and behold, they were written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah, who were carried away to Babylon for their transgression. Verse 2. Now the first inhabitants that dwelt in their possession in their cities were the Israelites, the priests, the Levites, and the Nethinims. And in Jerusalem dwelt of the children of Judah and of the children of Benjamin, and of the children of Ephraim and Manasseh, and so forth and so on. We'll take a look at these verses here. Now, verse number one shows you that Chronicles was written at least during or after the captivity, because it says all Israel was reckoned by genealogies, and they were carried away to Babylon for the transgression. So that verse shows you that it was written most likely, well, since Ezra wrote it, we've come to that decision. It was written after the captivity. And then it gives you a list of people here in verse 2. It's the first ones to come in to possess the land, and that's after the captivity. That's after the captivity after they come back. And it lists 1, 2, 3, 4 groups here, the Israelites, the priests, the Levites, and the Nethinims. Okay, that those 4 groups there you'll find in the chapter itself. The Israelites there, it says the first dwelling city were the Israelites. You'll find them in verses 3 to 9. Verses 3 to 9 is the Israelites. Israelites will be verses 3 to 9. Then the priests, the second group there, will be verses 10 to 13. Verses 10 to 13. And then the Levites, the third group, will be verses 14 to 16. And then the Nethinims, it doesn't kind of, it doesn't pick them out and give a name for them. They're kind of a strange group of people, and we'll get into that here in verse 2. Now, let me give you some cross-references, and you just write these down for these Jews that return under Ezra and Nehemiah. Here in verse 2, it talks about these people coming back, and if you write down Ezra chapter 2, and Ezra chapter 8, then Nehemiah chapter 7, 11, and 12, those chapters in Nehemiah, 7, 11, and 12. Those chapters in Ezra and Nehemiah have a list of people that came back from the captivity, and we don't have time in the course to really go back and research all those names out and everything and show you, but you can check those out and have the references on it yourself there. Now, in verse 2, the word nethinims shows up. This is the first time that word appears in the Bible. And it's clear in Chronicles. Clear up in the book of Chronicles. First time the word appears is in 1 Chronicles 9:2. The word nethinims means one given. One given. And what they were temple servants or temple slaves. They were fellows that just kind of did any kind of work that needed to be done around the temple. Now, they didn't take care of the ceremonial part in the temple, but they did the menial tasks and things like that. And that's what these nethinims were to do. Now, let me give you a couple things about them. The first time it appears is here in 1 Chronicles 9:2. That's the first thing I want you to see. That's point A. The point B is the only other book in the Bible, where the name Nethinim appears, is in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, so you can see again the association with Chronicles and Ezra, and the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. There's an association there. That's the only time that that word appears in the Bible, is in those three books: 1 Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Okay, now the word appears one time in Chronicles. This is point C. It appears one time in Chronicles, appears eight times in Ezra, and appears nine times in Nehemiah. One time in Chronicles, eight times in Ezra, and nine times in Nehemiah. The word appears. Okay, now in Ezra chapter 8, you don't have to turn there, but I'll read it unless you want to. Ezra chapter 8, verse 20, tells us a little bit about these fellows. This is point D. David appointed the Nethinims to help the Levites. That's Ezra 8:20. And Ezra 8:20 says, "Also the Nethinims, whom David and the princes had appointed for the service of the Levites, 220 Nethinims, all of them were expressed by name." And so that's the only clue in the Bible to who these fellows are. They were appointed by David to be servants for the Levites. And that's about all I can really tell you about them. Also in Ezra 7:24, the Nethinims do not pay taxes. Ezra 7:24 says, "Also we certify you that touching any of the priests and the Levites, singers, porters, Nethinims, or ministers of the house of God, it shall not be lawful to impose toll, tribute, or custom upon them." And so the Roman Catholic priest continues on with the tradition where they don't pay any taxes. Okay, so that's a few things about the Nethinims. Outside of that, they're kind of a vague group and who they are. Now, verses, I gave you the verses as far as the priests and the Levites and all that, where they go. And I'm not going to read all those because we need to just get through this chapter and start in chapter 10. But go down to verse 29. Verses 29 to 34. I'm sorry. Am I getting this? Verse 22. go to 22, sorry. Verse 22, I want to point out something there. Verse 22 says, all these which were chosen to be porters in the gates were 212. These were reckoned by their genealogy in their villages, whom David and Samuel the seer did ordain in their set office. Okay, here again, David is appointing some fellows to do some work, and Samuel the seer. And that word seer just means a prophet, okay? You can write down 1 Samuel 9:9. It just says in the old days they used to call them seers. 1 Samuel 9:9. Before time in Israel, when a man went up to inquire of God, thus he spake, come, let us go to the seer, for he that is now called a prophet was aforetime called a seer. That's 1 Samuel 9:9. And so it says here, Samuel the seer. It just means he was the prophet. And that's what they were called. They were called that before they were called prophets. Also in verse 22, you'll find some fellows there that are called porters. Now porters, all they were gatekeepers. Okay, the porters were gatekeepers. And you'll find that in verse 17 of the chapter. It says, and the porters were Salam and Akkub and Talmon and Ahiman and their brethren. Salmon was the chief. And it talks about the porters here and goes on down. These fellows were in the gates, it says in verse 22. Now, that's the first point about these fellows. Point A is they're keepers of the gate. Now, the first time they appear in the Bible, the word porter appears in the Bible, is in 2 Kings 7:11. 2 Kings 7:11, first time the word porters appears in the Bible. But it's not really in reference to a fellow working at the temple. That one's just a gatekeeper in the city. Now, point C, I want to give you all the times the word porter appears in the Bible, or the different books it appears. Okay, it's one time in 2 Kings, one time in 2 Kings, 12 times in the book of 1 Chronicles, 12 times in the book of 1 Chronicles, 5 times in the book of 2 Chronicles, 5 times in the book of Ezra, and 10 times in the book of Nehemiah. Did y'all get those? Okay. First two? Okay, one time in the book of 2 Kings and 12 times in the book of 1 Chronicles. So again, you'll see an association here with Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah. They're very closely associated. Okay, point D was that point, the association with Ezra and Nehemiah. And then point E is the porters are appointed by David, or were appointed by David. Okay. Now, Roman numeral 2 in the passage in chapter 9. Roman numeral number 2 is the genealogy of Saul, or Saul's family line. And that'll run from verses 35 to the end of the chapter. And for cross-references on these, you can write down 1 Chronicles 8, 33 to 40. 1 Chronicles 8, 33 to 40. And it'll help you see some of the other names that aren't given in this passage here. But the way it goes Ner, Kish, Saul, Jonathan. That's just the fathers down the line like that. And then it lists the sons of Jonathan, then on down, and then 6 sons of Aziel, who's found in verse 43 there. I'm not going to go and read all those names. I want to go ahead and get through those. So basically that just gives you Saul's line, and the reason they put that in there because Saul was the first king of Israel, and they showed you his genealogy there. But see, Saul, not being from the tribe of Judah, really wasn't one of their bona fide kings. He was the people's choice. And people said, you know, we want a king, and so God gave him one of their choice, just like when they said, you know, we have no king but Caesar, or we want Barabbas and not Jesus. They always pick the wrong guy. And so the Lord has his line that the king comes from, and he'll work it out. Okay, chapter 10. Chapter 10 now. And let me put a map up here, wake some of you up, and give you some visual aids to look at. want to put this up here. It shows the dwellings of the enemies in Canaan in the time of Judges. And where we're studying Chronicles, the events that took place in Chronicles, where we're at is not far removed from the Judges time period. Okay? In fact, Samuel is about one of the last judges, and then you have Saul starting out the king, and then David. And so we're just right at the end of the Judges, getting into the kingly line. And chapter 10, one point outline in chapter 10, it's just the death of Saul, verses 1 to 14. Okay, let me see here. What I want to do on this map up here, too, to kind of so you'll be able to see as we go down through the passage, we'll have to draw something out here. Okay, and I'll do it in red. When the children of Israel went in to take the land, they were supposed to take all of this and drive all the inhabitants out. Of course, they didn't do that. Some of them still were in the land. And then even in the days of Saul, there were still enemies of Israel dwelling in the land. Now, basically, the kingdom of Saul, what land area they really had under control, will be within the boundaries of this red line I'm going to draw. Let's see. Comes in something like this. Goes up. Kind of dips down in here. Comes out. Goes way up here and comes down like that. Something like that. That area right there within the red boundaries is what Israel controlled, except for that area, Jerusalem, and then there's Beth Shan. This area right in here. So see, even within the area of the kingdom of Israel, there were some enemies in there, and we're going to get into that in this passage right here. And see, they didn't drive out the enemy, and the enemies caused them a lot of problems. Okay, 1 Chronicles chapter 10, verse 1. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain at Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard after Saul and after his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Micaiah, the son of Saul. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was wounded of the archers. Then said Saul to his armor-bearer, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and abuse me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. So Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise in his sword and died. So Saul died, and his three sons and all the house and all his house died together. Okay, we'll stop there and take a look at some of those verses right now. Okay, verse number 1, Roman numeral number 1. I want to show you some things about the Philistines. Okay, Roman numeral number 1, some things about the Philistines. Just write that down, Roman numeral 1. Then point A, Philistines. Okay, the Philistines were from a Hamitic descent, or they were from the tribe of Ham, or from Ham's line. You can just write these verses down. Genesis 10, 14. Genesis 10, 14 tells us that they came from Ham. Genesis 10, 14, I'll just read it real quick. It's in the line of Ham. And it says, "And Pathrushim and Calcium, out of whom came Philistium." So Philistium was the first one that started the Philistines. And that's in Genesis 10:14. Then in 1 Chronicles 1:12, 1 Chronicles 1:12 within the book we've been studying, 1 Chronicles 1:12 says, in parentheses, in the middle of verse, "of whom came the Philistines," and that's right in the line of the sons of Ham. So they were descendants from Ham. They were not descendants from Abraham or even from the Shemites. They were from the African race. Now, point B, the Philistines are found more times in Saul and David's lives than any other enemy mentioned in their lives, okay? The Philistines are found more in the lives of Saul and David than any other enemies of Israel mentioned during their times. And that was one of Israel's worst enemies, the Philistines. I mean, all the time you read through Samuel, man, it's like those Philistines don't get the message, you know? I mean, they come up and they get whipped, and they keep coming back, and sometimes they'll win because God's chastening Israel for not obeying, and they'll get whipped, and they'll come back again. The story's coming back. The story's coming back. And they just never learn. Point C, the word Philistine is found in 1 Samuel 17 more than any other chapter of the Bible. In one chapter in the Bible, the word Philistine, 1 Samuel 17, the word Philistine is found 28 times. 28 times in one chapter. That's a lot of time. 1 Samuel chapter 17. It's found 28 times in that chapter. And the word Philistine or Philistines in the plural is found 149 times in Samuel, in 1 Samuel, more than any other book in the Bible. So in just the book of 1 Samuel, the name Philistine or Philistines found 149 times. That was point D. Now point E, the word Philistine is found 28 times in the book of 1 Chronicles. Point E, the word Philistine is found 28 times in the book of 1 Chronicles. And point F, Goliath was a Philistine of Gath. And of course, that chapter 17 deals with David killing Goliath. And it just mentions him over and over and over and over in the passage, the word Philistine. And Goliath was from there. Now, if you look on the map over here, this area down in here, the southern, southwestern seacoast line here, was the area where the Philistines inhabited. And Gath was down in this area. Now, it doesn't show it on the map here, but it's like right about in this area right in here where this red dot is. Somewhere in that area is where Gath was located. Now, the word Goliath, under point F, the word Goliath means revolution. Revolution or heap. Well, he was a revolutionist, and he became a heap. Heap, yeah. H-E-A-P, yeah, heap. You know, after David cut off his head, he's just a heap laying there. The birds came and ate his flesh. And so there's revolution connected with this fellow named Goliath. He's a type of the Antichrist defiling Israel, people of God, and you can type it out just about any way you want to on that. And he'll, of course, when the Antichrist gathers his armies together against Israel at the second coming, the outcome is everybody gets their flesh gets eaten by birds in Revelation there. Okay, now Roman numeral number 2 under verse 1 here, it says that the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain at Mount Gilboa. Mount Gilboa is right up in here. It's a little south of Tabor. It's right in this area right here, Mount Gilboa. In fact, right, the city of Jezreel is right in here. See, this says Valley of Jezreel on the map here? Okay, Jezreel's right up here in Mount Gilboa. So they're fighting in this area right up here. That's where the battle's going on. You know what battle's going to be fought there one of these days? Yeah, Armageddon. Valley of Jezreel or the Valley of Jehoshaphat or Megiddo, that's all basically the same area. It stretches down through this area right in here. And that's where a big battle is going to be fought one of these days when the Antichrist gathers his armies against Israel. And we're going to see a type of that in the passage. Now, Gilboa, the word Gilboa means revolution of inquiry. Revolution of inquiry. So again, there's something going on with a revolution. Revolution's a turnabout. You're trying to get a turn around from the system and, you know, set up something new. Verse 2. The Philistines followed hard after Saul and after his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan. Now, Jonathan was one of Saul's sons who was, he was a friend of David, but he got killed with his brothers here and his dad in battle. And Jonathan is going to type out a Christian that's not come completely out of the world. I mean, he loved the Lord, and he loved David. David's a type of Christ, and he tried to take care of David and protect him and everything, but yet he wouldn't break fellowship with his family and with his brethren, and so he died. See, when the enemies of God came in, and God used it to chase them, if you're in the way and you're a carnal Christian, you're going to suffer the consequences, just like Jonathan did here. Jonathan could have left and gone with David and followed David and his men, and later on got the reign. You see the type? So if you stay in the world as a Christian and you mess around with the world, when judgment comes, you're going to suffer the consequences and you're not going to get to reign. Not going to get to reign. That's the type in the passage. But Jonathan was, you know, a good man as far as it goes, as loving David, taking care of him and things like that, but he just wouldn't get away from his family. So he's a type of a compromising Christian. Verse number 3 says, and the battle was sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was wounded of the archers. Now Saul, in the passage, is going to type out the Antichrist. Now, not perfectly, because enemies, when God destroys them at the second coming, are going to be fighting not against Israel as they are here, but, against Saul like that. See, Saul represents Israel, but he's still going to type out the Antichrist in the passage. He's going to type out the Antichrist. And point A is about Saul typing out the Antichrist. I'm going to give you a couple points here about Saul typing out the Antichrist. Point A is he was the people's choice. It was the people's choice. 1 Samuel 8:7. Just as Barabbas was the people's choice. Matthew 27:20. They said, give us Barabbas. You know, crucify Jesus and give us Barabbas. And so the people picked out Saul, a man like themselves, and God picked out David, a man after his own heart. So the people always pick wrong. Now, point B, Saul tries to kill David. David, of course, is a type of Christ. So he's an antichrist. David, he tries to kill David. 1 Samuel 18:10-11. 1 Samuel 18:10-11. There tells about Saul. And he tried to kill David about four times, threw a javelin at him a few times, sent some guys up to his house one day to kill him in bed. And of course, his wife put a little statue in there of Baal or somebody, and they thought it was him, and it wasn't. And he hunted for him and tried to kill him, and so he's the type of the Antichrist, just like Herod tried to kill Jesus Christ, Matthew 2:16-18. Matthew 2:16-18. Herod sent out a decree to kill all the children 2 years and under. Why? To destroy Jesus Christ, who was the King of the Jews. So he and Herod also was a type of the Antichrist. Point C, Saul in the passage is killed before the rightful king takes the throne. Saul is killed before the rightful king takes the throne, just as the Antichrist will be killed before the rightful king takes the throne. 1 Chronicles 10:11 explain that, where Saul's killed in chapter 10, chapter 11, David gets the throne. Just like Revelation 19, just the whole chapter there, Revelation 19, Jesus Christ comes back, destroys the Antichrist, the beast, the false prophet, those guys, and then he takes the throne. So Saul's killed before the rightful king takes the throne, just as the Antichrist is. Point D, he's killed in the area of Jezreel. Jezreel. Just as the Antichrist armies will be killed in this area too, the Valley of Jezreel, the Valley of Megiddo, or the Valley of Jehoshaphat, all basically in the same area. Now, we'll just write down these references. 1 Chronicles 10:1. Joel 3:14. Revelation 9:16. Revelation 9:16. Revelation 19, 11 to 20. Revelation 19, 11 to 20. And being slaughtered there and stuff by the Lord. Okay? Zechariah 14:4. Zechariah 14:4. Now, verses 3 to 5, I want to point out a couple things here. Point A, Saul is hit by an arrow. And the wound that he receives here in battle would be bad enough to kill him if he... lived. I mean, if he didn't take his own life, okay? But he wanted to take his own life. He received a wound. It would have killed him. It was a fatal wound, but it didn't just kill him right away. And so he committed suicide before the enemy caught him. Now, the cross passage on this, or which seems to be a problem passage on the cross reference, is 2 Samuel 1:5-15. And let me turn there and read that. 2 Samuel 1, 5 to 15. Okay, now before I read it, I want to make, let me see. I'll make my other point here. In 1 Chronicles 10, you see here that Saul takes a sword and he falls upon it. He commits suicide with a sword, okay? Now you have to remember that. Now in 2 Samuel 1, verse 5 says, "And David said unto the young man," what happens, this young man, it was an Amalekite, comes to David after the battle. This is a parallel passage to where we're reading in Chronicles. Comes to David after the battle where Saul's killed. And basically he says, tells David that Saul and his sons are dead. And he came upon Saul at Mount Gilboa. And here's what the Amalekite says. And he says, "And the young man that told him said, 'As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, "Here am I." And he said unto me, "Who art thou?" And I answered him, "I am an Amalekite." And he said unto me, "Again, stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me." So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet and so forth. So what this kid does, he tells David, I happened to go past Saul when he was wounded, and Saul leaned upon his spear, which was not true. And this fellow says, "I got his crown and bracelet here." And so he brought it to David, thinking that David would give him a reward for killing off Saul. He says, so I went ahead and killed him, because I was sure he wasn't going to live. And of course, David says in verse 13, David said unto the young man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered and said, "I'm the son of a stranger, an Amalekite." And David said unto him, "How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" David called for one of the young men, and he said, "Go near and fall upon him," and he smote him that he died. So David had that Amalekite killed. Well, David was such a man of honor that he never, said anything about the king, the Lord's anointed, and things like that. And when somebody came and told him, "I killed him," David says, "Well, you're going to die for touching the Lord's anointed." And the man was lying to David all along, though. See, so the guy got caught in his own trap. He told a lie that, "I got this crown and bracelet from Saul, and I killed him, and your enemy's dead now." And he was thinking he'd get a reward from David. But David, being the man that he was, and man of honor, and David was a real man, he had that fella killed for touching the Lord's anointed. And so some people say, well, over in this passage it says he's leaned on his spear, but over here it says a sword. See, there's no problem that the guy's just lying in one passage. It just records what a fellow says. The actual account, what really happens, is in 1 Chronicles and also in the end of First Samuel in chapter 31. Now, the Amalekite, here's point B, the Amalekite lied to David thinking to receive a reward, and that's found in 2 Samuel 4, 9, and 10. 2 Samuel 4, 9, and 10. See, David, another situation like that comes up with Ishbosheth, who was killed, and some guys thinking they'd get some reward from David for doing that. And then David refers back to this incident where Saul was killed, or supposedly was killed, by the Amalekite. And in 2 Samuel 4, 9, it says, "And David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Rehum, the Beeronite, and said unto them, As the Lord liveth, who hath redeemed my soul out of all adversity, when one told me, saying," now he's referring back to Saul's death, "Behold, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good tidings, I took hold of him and slew him in Ziglag, who thought that I would have given him a reward for his tidings." So see, that Amalekite thought, "I'm going to really get paid off here, and David's going to take care of me for getting rid of his enemy." But David, again, being the man that he was, didn't do that, and he killed him. And then also in 2 Samuel 4, there he kills those other guys for killing Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. David wasn't your typical guy that, you know, when he had an enemy like Saul or one of Saul's sons, he just didn't feel like, you know, going out and killing them. He just put it in the Lord's hand, let the Lord do it. And so David was a man that trusted God. Now, verse 4, back in 1 Chronicles 10, 4, Saul says here, Saul sent his armor bearer, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through withal, lest thy uncircumcised come and abuse me." And what he's talking about there, about the abuse, is if you want a good idea what it is, write down Judges 16, 21 to 25. Judges 16, 21 to 25, where they took Samson, the Philistines, again it was the Philistines, and it says they made sport of him. What they did is they stripped him and they tortured him, they put his eyes out, made fun of him, mocked him, drug him around the city and stuff like that. And so Saul didn't want to go through all that stuff, you know. And of course it's done even today when there's wars going on, and you know, you think man's come a long way, but even in, you know, World War II, Vietnam War, same type of things happen when they catch prisoners. You know, they abuse them, make sport of them, fun of them, stuff like that. And that's what was going to happen to Saul, and he knew it. And that was just a thing that the Philistines did. And it's nothing that's outdated. It's still going on today when man has wars. So Saul didn't want that, and so he fell upon his sword and took his own life. So he dies there. Now, I'm going to read verses 6 to 10. "So Saul died, and his three sons and all his house died together. And when all the men of Israel that were in the valley saw that they fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, then they forsook their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his sons fall on the Mount Gilboa. And when they had stripped him, they took his head and his armor and sent unto the land of the Philistines round about to carry tidings to their idols and to the people. And they put his armor in the house of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon." Okay, so this is, you know, something that's still done even today. I mean, you know, I've seen pictures of Vietnam, things like that, where they'd, you know, take people and drag them behind tanks and stuff like that that they'd killed, you know, and just all sorts of things. And so what they're doing here with Saul, they cut his head off, and that was kind of like a thing of victory in those times, is you'd cut the enemy's head off and you just paraded around, you know. And so that was the end of Saul. His head's cut off, and he's paraded around in the area of the Philistines and their towns and things like that in their coast, and they take his armor and put it in their temple. For example, David in 1 Samuel 17 did the same thing to Goliath. Goliath lost his head, and they took his armor also, okay? So that was kind of like a, you know, I guess like the Indians used to do, you know, with scalps, you know, cut the scalp and hang it on your little belt, or notches on your pistol, you know, stuff like that. It, you know, man's really come a long way, and he's still doing the same thing, you know? And so basically that's what they were doing there. And they take the armor, in verse 10, says, "and put in the house of their gods." Now, if you just write down 1 Samuel 31:10, 1 Samuel 31:10, and that's in the house of Ashtaroth. 1 Samuel 31 verse 10 says, "And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth and fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan." Now, what they do is they have a bunch of temples, and Ashtaroth is the female deity, okay, that the Philistines worship. Ashtaroth or Ashtartes or Esther or Easter, they're all the same thing. The names are changed to protect the guilty. And so 1 Samuel 31:10 is where you find him putting the armor there. Now, his head goes in the temple of Dagon. Now, Dagon is the masculine deity of the Philistines. You know, they got the male and the female. And it was a practice of the Philistines to take the spoils of war to the house of their god, especially to Dagon. You can write down 1 Samuel 5:1-5. 1 Samuel 5:1-5. I got to read this one because it's so good. But see, that was it. When they won a war or took spoil, they'd take it to old Dagon. You know, bow down to Dagon because Dagon gave them the victory and all that. And 1 Samuel 5:1-5, they do something that they shouldn't have done. They took the Ark of God. They got the Ark of God and they take it in there to Dagon and say, "Look, we got this God of the Israelites, he's a little wimpy God and he can't take care of himself, and we're going to put him down here and bow down to Dagon." So here's how the thing goes. 1 Samuel 5:1-5. "And the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer unto Ashdod." Ashdod. Now, I think Ashdod, well, Ashdod's right down here on the coastline. It's not shown on that map there. And when the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon. That's the same place where they took Saul's head. Or will take Saul's head. Let me think here. Yeah, they will take Saul's head. And set it by Dagon. So, you know, you got Dagon, and I think the statue was, it was like a man's body, and he had his hands up like this, and he's standing like that. And the ark's sitting right in front of him, kind of bowing down to Dagon, you know, because the God of the Israelites, he can't take care of himself, and Dagon, he's all powerful. And verse 3, "And when they of Ashdod arose early on the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. And they took Dagon and set him up in his place again." So, you know, that night, it must have been an earthquake or something. I'm sure it was a coincidence that, you know, Dagon just happened to fall down on his face there before the ark of God. Just a coincidence. Just like when they came to get Jesus and he says, "Who seek ye?" And they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I am." What happened? They just kind of fell down, you know. The power of God. And verse 4, "And when they arose early on the morrow," so the next day they go in there, priest to Dagon, "behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face again." Poor Dagon just got his face in the ground. "All the time to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And that, now look, the head of Dagon and both his palms of his hands were cut off upon the threshold. Only the stump of Dagon was left unto him." So, you know, he's like this. There must be a doorway or something there, and he's like this, and he falls, you know, boom, over. And so his palms are cut off, and his head cuts off right across that threshold. And so here they have a little superstition then after this. Verse 5, "Therefore neither the priest of Dagon nor any that come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day." I mean, you know, that's, isn't that a superstition too? Don't they still do that? Some, you know, don't step on the threshold or something, or don't step on the crack or something like that, you know. Same type of thing going on there. And so the old Dagon god there, he couldn't take care of himself, and he got all busted up, and the Ark of God got sent back where it came from because there's too much power in it. So you can just write down ha-ha, laugh-laugh there under that reference, 1 Samuel 5:1-5. Now, Dagon, here's something for you. It's pronounced Dagon, Dagon, Dagon or Dagon. You ever say Dagon? What do you say Dagon for? Dagon or Dagon? Dagon, Dagon. All you're doing is just cursing by a Philistine god. That's all you're doing. Shouldn't say that. Dagon or Dagon or Dagon. That's not good. Because that's, okay. Now, what Dagon is, he's a fish god. In fact, the word, let's see if I got it down here. Well, the word means fish god. That's what it means. It means fish god. He's the fish god. Number one, that's the first point. Dagon is the fish god. Number two, the priest of Dagon wore a little beanie or mitre with their god's head on it. And it was just a little mitre. It came up like this. It was kind of like a fish head. You know, something like that. Oh, I'm sorry, you can't see that. That's a largemouth bass there. And and they wore those things. You can find this information in Babylon Mystery Religion or Hyslop's book on two Babylons. And it's kind of like, you know, you ever seen the mitre the Pope wears? Looks like the same thing. And Dagon was in several forms, but he was a half-man, half-fish sometimes. And you know where mermaids come from? The Ashtaroth was a half-woman, half-fish. That's one of those pagan goddesses. That's number three, half-man, half-fish. Number four, this Christian symbol that, you know, we all that are saved go by. Can you see that? The fish symbol. And it's got some kind of characters in it. That's not Christian at all, man. That thing's been around. The symbol of the fish has been around a long time, way back in the days of the Philistines. You know, just like the cross is supposedly a Christian symbol. Well, you ever see some Egyptian hieroglyphics and pictures, and you'll find a little thing like that. It's called an ankh, and it's a cross. The Egyptians carried that thing around 1,000 years, 2,000 years before Jesus Christ showed up. So it's not a sacred symbol. It's a pagan symbol. So that's the fish symbol, number four. And then number five, you know, Good Friday, you only eat fish on Good Friday. Those Catholics are always eating their gods. They're always eating their gods, you know, a little wafer god, a little fish god, that's what they do. And it's nothing new because that's what the Philistines did way back when, you know. So that's just a little bit on Dagon and Ashtaroth and some things like that. And I can see I'm not even going to get through chapter 10 tonight. Number three was half man, half fish. And Ashtaroth is the female counterpart, the mermaid. Okay, verse 11 and 12, let me give you this. Now let me get the map back up here and kind of straighten it out because I want you to see. See this. Okay. Is that very clear? It doesn't look too clear. Now, what happens here after Saul dies and his body's hung on that wall at Bethshan? Bethshan is this area right here. See where this one area is I showed you that was within the confines of the boundaries of Saul's kingdom? That's where Bethshan is located. That was one of the strongholds of the Philistines, just as Jerusalem down here was a stronghold of the Jebusites. So the Philistines took Saul's body and they just hung it up on the wall with his boys out there. And then there's a place right off here, just not too far, maybe 5 miles away, called Jabesh Gilead. And Jabesh Gilead, there were Jews living there. And they heard that Saul's body was out there. And so verse 11 and 12 is what this is about. And when all Jabesh Gilead heard that what the Philistines had done to Saul, they arose, all the valiant men, and took away the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons and brought them to Jabesh and buried their bones under an oak tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. So these men of Jabesh Gilead did a valiant thing here and come and, you know, kind of take the shame away from Israel, bury Saul and his sons. The parallel passage to that is 1 Samuel 31:11-13. And let's see. I'm going to get ahead of myself here. Okay, the reason the men of Jabesh Gilead did this valiant act is found in 1 Samuel 11:1-15. 1 Samuel 11:1-15. The reason they did that was because when Saul, just before he was king, or made king, a man by the name of Nahash the Ammonite. Nahash the Ammonite came up against the people of Jabesh-Gilead and said, you're going to be my servants. And they said, okay, we'll be your servants. What do you want us to do? And he said he's going to pluck out their eye or something, you know, pluck out one of their eyes or something. And, you know, they thought, well, that's not too good. They said, let's see if we can get somebody to help us or something. We'll let you know about that, you know. So they went and Saul found out about it. And so Saul came up and delivered them from the hand of Nahash the Ammonite. And so that's why the men of Jabesh-Gilead went up there and took Saul's body down and his sons. And you'll find that, as I gave you, 1 Samuel 11, 1 to 15. Parallel passage, 1 Samuel 31, 11 to 13, I gave you that. That mentions the first cremation in the Bible. Because there, it doesn't tell you here in this passage, there the men of Jabesh-Gilead took Saul's and his sons' bodies and burned them. They burned them and then they took their bones and buried them. That's why it says here, they buried their bones. It doesn't say their body. See here in 1 Chronicles 10, 12, buried their bones under an oak because they burned them up. The reason they did that, they didn't want, I guess, anybody digging them up and hanging them up again, so they just burned them. But a cremation, of course, it's not, you know, people say, is cremation Christian? Is it something you can do? Well, in the context of the thing, it's not that great. I mean, Saul died, you know, suicidal, dishonorable, and it doesn't look like it. Is anything that, you know, you'd want to happen. I mean, that's what happens to the Antichrist and his armies. They get burned up when the Lord comes back. So I don't think it has anything to do with Christianity. Okay, their bodies were on the wall of Bethshan. That's a stronghold, gave you that. Now, Saul was buried under an oak. It says he's buried under an oak. And the parallel passage in Samuel says it was a tree. So it's an oak tree. If you run across references on oak, man, oaks in the Bible, there's nothing really good about them. They're associated with idol worship, devils, things like that. Probably the tree that Jesus Christ was crucified on was probably an oak tree. Doesn't say that, but most likely it was. Okay, verses 13 and 14 will end the chapter. So Saul died for his transgression which he committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord, which he kept not, and also for asking counsel of one that had a familiar spirit to inquire of it, and inquired not of the Lord. Therefore he slew him and turned the kingdom unto David, the son of Jesse. Now, just a couple things on this here. Two reasons for the death of Saul. Number one, he did not keep the word of the Lord. That's the first thing. He didn't keep the word of the Lord. So we need to apply that to our lives. We need to keep the word of the Lord. He didn't keep the word of the Lord. 1 Samuel 13, 8 to 14. 1 Samuel 13, 8 to 14, that's where he usurped the authority of the priesthood. He didn't wait on Samuel, so he didn't keep the commandment of the Lord. Only the priests were supposed to do that. And also, 1 Samuel 15, 1 to 23. 1 Samuel 15, 1 to 23, he didn't kill Agag, king of the Amalekites. Okay, he didn't kill Agag. He was supposed to kill them all, and he kept some of the cattle too. And so he disobeyed again. And the Bible says that rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. To obey is better than sacrifice. And so we need to realize that. To obey the Lord is better than to buy him off with a tithe or something. He wants you to obey him. And so because rebellion is the sin of witchcraft, that's the second reason that Saul died. He went to a witch. That's number two. Reason for his death was for not seeking the Lord. Not seeking the Lord, he went to a witch. 1 Samuel 28, 7 to 20. 1 Samuel 28, 7 to 20, he went to the witch of Endor. You know, that's a witch's name, isn't it? Endora? Endora. Endora was a witch's name in one of those shows about witches or something they had. So see, just carries right on through. Way back then, Endora. The witch of Endor. And that's found in 1 Samuel 28, 7 to 20. Now, 1 Samuel 28, 6, where it says he sought the Lord, may look like a contradiction to 1 Chronicles 10, 14. It says, and inquired not of the Lord. Here it says Saul didn't inquire of the Lord, and 1 Samuel 28, 6 says that he inquired of the Lord, and the Lord didn't answer it. What it is here's the reasons for that. It's not a contradiction. It looks like one, but it's not. Sometimes you have to just wait on the Lord for an answer. Saul inquired, and the Lord didn't answer, so he decided he's going to do something else. So sometimes you need to wait on the Lord, or sometimes, as in the case of Saul, he's just through with you. He's just through with you. Now, in the Old Testament, when God got through with you, that was, he was through with you. You know, thank God for grace. We're under grace, and, you know, he'll never leave us nor forsake us. But if he doesn't answer, man, don't go to the devil. Don't go to the witch of Endor and get your answer. Wait on the Lord or die, but don't go to the witch of Endor. Okay? Just some good biblical advice. In the law, Leviticus 19:31, said you were not to inquire if anybody had a familiar spirit, a wizard or a witch or anybody like that. Leviticus 19:31, don't inquire of them. And Exodus 22:18 said kill the witches. So if a woman says she's a witch, you need to kill her. Exodus 22:18. Of course, that was under the law, but I think it'd be good to do it today. You know, of course, I think the Puritans in the Salem witch trials really probably got carried away with it and just had a grudge against somebody and, ah, they're a witch, let's kill them, you know. But if, you know, nowadays it's really just out. You know, people say they're witches and stuff like that, and we can tell the future and all that stuff. And yeah, so Bible said to kill them. Now, another thing, Saul took counsel of the devil just like the Antichrist will. 2 Thessalonians 2:7-10. 2 Thessalonians 2:7-10. Man, I am not going to get through it. No. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I only got 5 pages of notes to finish. I don't think we're going to make it. Okay, we'll stop there. And next week we'll pick up chapter 11. And probably what will happen, I'm not going to be able to go and read every passage. Now, the important ones I will, but you're just going to have to write them down, check them out for yourself so we can go ahead and get through the material. I should have been through chapter 11 tonight, and we just got to it. So we'll stop there.